You're listening to CKUT. The following programming is taken from CKUT's Time Capsule Archives. For more from our 35 years of freeform broadcasting, visit our website at ckut.ca.
18 hammers fall in our lives. There ain't no hammer in a ring like mine. Yeah!
Funky Revolutions, for the fattest of the funk and other liberation musics. Saturdays, 2 to 4 p.m., pure funk and the shuffle of people marching in the streets. On CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Everything I do gonna be funky.
Revolution.
For your mind and for your hips, you're tuned to the Mothership. This is the Mothership Cassette Archives, 25 years of funky revolutions. Today's episodes, we begin to present a series on the development of soul, funk, jazz, and disco in South Africa, originally aired in the winter of 2015. On today's episode 10 of the Cassette Archives, we present first part one, Apartheid and the Diversity of Soul and Funk in South Africa, originally airing on 31st of January 2015, followed by part two of Censorship and the Role of Radio in the Development of Soul, Funk and Jazz in South Africa, originally aired on the 7th of February 2015.
Funky revolutions, funky.
Funky revolutions, funky.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Funky revolutions,
whoa,
funky.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Funky revolutions, funky.
You are listening to Funky Revolutions.
Before. My name is Khalid and this is the Mothership Connection, Funky Revolutions. Announced it a few months ago that we would eventually bring our mothership to land in the distinguished cultural history of South Africa. We start today on CKUT 90.3 FM with the roots, development and expression of folk, funk, soul, disco jive in South Africa. A very diverse country, as we'll discover, a period of music that really is bracketed by the term of apartheid, a music as much created and developed in South Africa as by artists in exile, as we'll see, a land of Bantu and Zulu and various ethnicities, territory that will include up until 1990 what is now Namibia, a country that intervened among its neighbors, including Mozambique, and, Angola, a country that shares its musical heritage and its modernization musically with Malawi, with Zimbabwe. On CKUT 90.3 FM, to start this part one, the diversity of South African soul, funk, and jazz, we start with a group that started basically in exile. In 1977, he was working in the Netherlands, Tembe, and then described this song, wrote this song, Johannesburg Love Trip, to describe the kind of urban centers and diverse languages and regions of South Africa. So as we land the mothership for this long stay in South Africa, we start with Thembi and the glorious Johannesburg Love Trip on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Victoria! Love, 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 love
CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. The music of Thembi to start a tour of the languages and major centers of Johannesburg from 1977. Thembi, the album he produced in the Netherlands at the time, was called Take Me Back to Transvaal. Johannesburg love trip to start this part on the diversity of soul, funk, and jazz in apartheid. This part one of our series of the exploration of these musics and their development in South Africa over the next few months. From that, we heard the song Harari around 1976. The name would stick. They recorded the album Zimbabwe after a tour where 3 weeks turned into several months, and their popularity rose. They formed as the Beaters at the end of the 1960s, inspired by hippie funk soul and as well guitar jazz. The Beaters, that is, originally, and they were formed a group of musicians around the singer and leader Selby Ntuli, with Sifo Mabusi on drums, Alec Kwali on bass, and two guitarists to front the group. They did a soul kind of music starting in 1969 with Soul Agogo, and eventually adopted or had the name forced on them. The song was so popular that the Beaters became Harari. And on CKUT 90.3 FM, the sound of soul funk from South Africa to fascinate us over the next few weeks. It's music that is basically developed and expressed and evolves under apartheid from the beginning of that structure and regime, that term apartheid, keeping apart. It is the practice and the legislation and the realities of apartheid that will inform in part how the music develops in townships, in urban centers, and for people in exile. That apartheid system that develops not suddenly. There's a history of slavery and segregation in the colonization and conflicts that brought both the Bantu people into South Africa in their migrations over 1,000 years, including the Zulu peoples and the Xhosa. It includes the Dutch Afrikaners and French Huguenots and Germans who arrived to form the Boers and the Afrikaners. Then the takeover at the end of the 18th century by the British, and these tensions would develop as the Zulus expanded at the beginning of the 19th century, the Zulu Wars at the end of third quarters of that century. All of these will structure and form, but segregation, distinction, but will really be actualized in 1948 with what becomes then the National Party, mostly Afrikaners, mostly led by the union, unions representing Afrikaners, who with the change in economy after the huge bounce and boom of the World War II, as jobs that had been assumed and filled by blacks began to compete with white Afrikaners working, for example, in the mines. Well, this led to this movement and this politics and practice of separation. It accrued, the system became even more violent with time as it was challenged. It's a music that would go right into trenching laws that made culture itself an impractical experience, as we'll discover over the course of the next few months. On CKUT 90.3 FM, we head into that aspect, and I thought we had to just open the apartheid experience, as it would really create censorship, interdictions, even going as far as refusing the possibility of mixed crowds and mixed performers by interdicting places and people and ideas, banning songs. On CKUT 90.3, over the next few months, I hope to share with you this complex experience that will create South African soul, funk, and disco jazz. On CKUT, we go to a group that formed basically in the 80s, in the 70s, around a man called Temba Matabesi, a guitarist who went into exile. The album we're going to hear speaks of apartheid and was created in 1987, but the group itself starts in around 1975. He had been working for this British TV show as a music coordinator, and he would go to Lagos and begin working with the T-Fires, recording his first album, Nonstop Disc Music, a second album as well with in 1983. And then again in Lagos, he recorded this album, which speaks of the reality of South Africa and the contestations and violence of the time. The first song is itself called Apartheid. On CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, this is Ouandile and Apartheid on CKUT 90.3 from 1987.
School is around the corner, and this year brings a new challenge. A recent report from the Quebec Federation of School Directors showed that 5,000 teaching positions across the province were still vacant ahead of the fall term. That's roughly three times last year's number. Those numbers are off-island, but there are hundreds of full and part-time positions going unfilled right here in Montreal, and the start of term is less than a week away. Quebec Education Minister Bernard Drainville has lowered teaching requirements to make up for the shortage. He's looking for one adult per classroom and says candidates don't need an education degree or even a bachelor's degree in order to qualify. Teachers' unions say this isn't fair to students or teachers. They want better conditions in the classroom and better pay to address post-COVID burnout. Today, we'll hear from one of those unions. Sébastien Joly is executive director of the Quebec Provincial Association of Teachers, which represents some 8,000 teachers in Quebec's English school boards. Sébastien, thanks so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Let's get straight to the issue. How bad exactly is the teacher shortage in Quebec? And what kind of stories are you hearing right now from educators in the province?
Well, it's not a new problem. It's a problem that was foreseeable. For the government, teacher unions and other educational stakeholders have advised the Quebec government to look into and address the situation a long time ago to prevent this from happening. And it's multifaceted, obviously, and it's not the same everywhere. It varies from region to region, from school board to school board, or service center to service center. In the English sector, it is problematic, but not as acute as it can be in the French sector. First of all, it's a problem of attraction and retention of personnel in the first place. So attraction, the profession is not attracting enough students. So when a student comes out of CEGEP, has to pick a profession, will not, as much as was the case in the past, pick the field of education. And working conditions that have been deteriorating over the years is one of the reasons. Their salary, of course, you provide better salaries. It will attract candidates, but also improving the working conditions. And one of the main issues when it comes to working conditions that affects working conditions and the day-to-day of the teachers is the class composition.
Yeah, so why don't you tell me a little bit more about that? What is class composition?
Class composition is the types of students you have in your classroom. So if we want to go back 15 years ago or 20 years ago, and in English sector, we have a high level of inclusion and integration of Pashtuni students in the regular classroom. So what we call the so-called regular classroom, previously 15, 20 years ago, we could have maybe five or six students with a range of difficulties or disabilities in the classroom. with the IEPs, individual education plans. Now, what we're seeing in the past couple of years is more of a picture where you have 8, 10, 12 to 15 students with special needs in the classroom with a range of difficulties, a diversity of difficulties, with very little resources to help out and to help them succeed.
Yeah, I'm just going to jump in there. So why do you think that we've seen this change over the years? Like what, yeah, why do you think the class composition has been changing so drastically over the years?
Well, I mean, there are probably a number of factors that explain that. First factor being that we've been more thorough in evaluating, assessing students early on and identifying their difficulties or their disabilities. And it seems to be that there are more students with special needs, more students with ADHD in a classroom. In the English Network, we ran some surveys over the years about special needs and organizational services, and we're talking about more or less about 20, sometimes 25% of student body who has special needs.
Have you seen those increases more, that students need more assistance since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic? I mean, we've seen sort of some teacher shortages, not just in Quebec, but in parts of Canada and the US. And I'm just curious in terms of what you've seen here in Quebec and what some of the differences are between the challenges we're facing in the province and more broadly in the sector as a whole.
Well, more broadly, you're right. I mean, it's not only a situation that pertains to Quebec. We are in contact on a regular basis with our partners from the rest of Canada as members of Canadian Teacher Federation. We are seeing that the shortage is in every province. We're seeing a devaluing of the teaching profession and a lack of valuing education in society in most provinces. We will start a campaign at the Canadian Teacher Federation to address the issue of attraction and retention in the coming year. So it is spreaded out. Now, the pandemic certainly had a major impact to exacerbate the situation. So with students accumulating delays during the pandemic, we're still playing catch up. A lot of students are not at level when they get to high school, for example. And that's an added pressure on school teams when it comes to achieving educational success.
Yeah, so there's clearly the obstacles that students are facing, right, and the impacts of the pandemic, as well as on educators, because we are facing a massive shortage in the province. There's been a lot of different, I guess, explanations that are around. Some people say this is post-COVID burnout. It's underinvestment in the sector. Others are blaming the seniority system, right? Saying that new teachers are being given the toughest classes. They're not wanting to stay in the profession. I guess, what do you make of the public discourse around the crisis in education in Quebec right now?
Well, I mean, you named a lot of the of factors that actually contribute to the situation and problematic. I would say most of these elements are accurate. But when, you know, the government is blaming the seniority system, I mean, it's not a reality that's very acute in the English sector. Usually the workloads that new teachers are when they're coming in, it's always challenging anyway. But there's kind of a balancing out in the English sector of the workloads. So this is not a huge factor. I mean, the main factor is the lack of support resources, specialized resources, adequate and sufficient resources, but also all the pressures that are added up on the shoulders of teachers over the years with a result-based management approach in education that doesn't work. And that was introduced, by the way, by François Legault when he was Minister of Education back in the early 2000s. So this philosophy or this approach to education doesn't work anywhere. The research shows it doesn't work, but certainly adds additional pressure for teachers and students to achieve educational success and to meet targets of success rates. All the while, you know, the class composition is not better. It's actually more challenging. And when we're talking about the shortage of teachers, one element that has to do with orientations taken by the current government, which was an electoral promise to actually increase the number of four-year-old kindergarten classes across the province. Principals' associations, teacher unions, other stakeholders have said to the government, you should probably put a hold on the expansion of four-year-old kindergarten because that causes, an increase in terms of the needs for teachers and other resources. So not that we're opposed philosophically to expanding the four-year-old kindergarten, but currently with the shortage of teachers, it's not working. I mean, we don't have enough teachers to fulfill their positions, these positions, and often at times we have inexperience on non-legally qualified teachers fulfilling those positions.
Yeah, so you mentioned the, a results-based approach that was introduced by François Legault, the four-year kindergarten expansion. What else has the CAC government's approach to the sector been? What are you seeing from the provincial government in terms of, where their interests lie in terms of legislation and investment?
As an organization, we have participated to parliamentary commissions about Bill 40, where it was a move to abolish school boards as a structure. We certainly did not think that it was the main issue to address, but that was one of their priorities, and it did not bring about any positive results, as you can see. Now there's a Bill 23 that was tabled earlier in the spring, in May. It's in the course of being adopted in the fall, and certainly we have not seen any measure there that will help improving the situation. To the contrary, a lot of elements from this bill actually will contribute to either devalue the teaching profession, reduce the level of autonomy of teachers, which is a good portion of what you need to do in order to value the teachers as professionals. And we really don't see anything within this bill that will actually substantially improve the situation. We're talking about symbolic things rather than true meaningful measures in order to help out the teachers in the classroom. Now, we're currently in a round of provincial negotiations, renegotiating our contract. This is the opportunity for the government to really bring about meaningful measures in order to improve the teachers' workload, to alleviate the pressures on the teachers, and to help in adding additional resources to support the teachers and the students.
What, I guess, are you expecting from those negotiations? You expressed your displeasure with Bills 23 and 40, saying that the centralization of education under the minister was devaluing or disrespecting the work of teachers. Now, Education Minister Bernard Drainville has been under fire for saying that the goal is to just have one adult in every classroom, whether or not they're a qualified teacher. Yeah, I guess, what do you think of the government's response to the crisis so far, and what are you anticipating as negotiations continue?
Well, certainly in the short term, I guess he cannot say anything differently than what he's saying right now. He knows what the situation is. He has some data about the shortage of teachers. He knows that we cannot train teachers over a period of a weekend. That's the only thing I can say, is that as much as possible to get one adult per classroom, whether they're qualified or non-qualified or have a high school diploma or a CEJAP or a bachelor's degree. I think school boards and service centers are doing their best to find the best possible person to be in the classroom to serve the students, because they understand that it represents added pressures on the school teams when people who are not qualified, who have not gone through the teacher training programs in the university, who are not certified or inexperienced, are entering the classroom. They need support from their colleagues, from the administrators. So it does represent an added burden for the school teams in general. So when Minister Drainville is saying that that's his goal, I mean, his goal is that every position be filled by an adult. Fair enough. At the same time, they continue on with the implementation of four-year-old kindergarten. they have not done anything meaningful in order to alleviate the pressures on the show's teachers. We are hoping that this current crisis will open their eyes on the importance of reinvesting substantially in education. A lot of studies came out in the past few years from OECD or other organizations or professors from various universities in the field of education, whereby, and even economists, whereby they're talking about $1 invested in education will bring about $3 in the economy as a return. For too long, the governments have considered education as an expense. It is not an expense. It is an investment in the future, in our children, in our society, in our democracy. We've been looking at solutions for years and years. It's time for them to listen.
Yeah, so if you were speaking to the minister today, what kind of policies would you ask to be put in place? What kind of investments does the sector need right now?
Well, again, the challenge of shortage of teachers is also spreading out to shortage of other kinds of personnel in the education sector. So there's no magic solution, but there's several measures that could be put into place in order to further attract teachers or students in teaching program. In other professions, for example, or other fields, sometimes, in the business world, we're not in the business world, but, they would probably suggest to pay tuition for student teachers, perhaps suggesting to pay them when they do their practicum, to offer to reimburse their student loans when they enter the profession, as long as they remain in the profession. So those are measures that, we have not consulted our members about that, but I'm just throwing ideas out there. When it comes to the current round of negotiation, we need to examine properly all the proposals we have in our demand. We spend a full year consulting our members about various solutions, about what their needs are, and we have deposited the demand last October with the result that we received an offer from the government that does not really address any of our demands. So now it's time for the government to get serious and to sit down and to look at real solutions that would have a meaningful impact.
Yeah, on that note, you said that negotiations are ongoing. You haven't received the offer that you would like, the teachers would like from the government. How do you see this escalating further, right? There's a lot of public awareness right now over the crisis in education in Quebec. Do you see any interest or appetite in a strike among education workers, or just what's the kind of mood among the folks that you're talking to?
Certainly. I mean, the sentiment amongst teachers right now is that the government is not really listening to them, not really caring for the well-being of teachers, for the working conditions that they're doing their jobs every day in, and the will to really improve the situation. Obviously, no one within the education system, including teachers, wants to go on strike or wants to carry out heavy ways of negotiating, but it will likely come to it. A number of our local unions will have general assemblies in the fall, and because things are not moving at the table, and whether we will have to go get strike mandates, it's very possible that the majority of our members will want to go that direction to get things to move. And certainly what we're seeing also is parents are more and more concerned with the quality of education in Quebec in light of the situation of the shortage of teachers. And hopefully they will support, the public will support teachers and other education workers in this round of negotiation. We have seen what happened recently in Ontario. There was a huge public mobilization against some of the policies of the Ford government. Well, same thing should be happening here in Quebec. And we will need all to mobilize for the same cause, which is quality of education for our students.
That was Sébastien Joly, executive director of the Quebec Provincial Association of Teachers, which represents some 8,000 teachers in Quebec's English school boards. I'm Jules Bijal. Thanks for listening. You're listening to CKUT, broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at ckut.ca. I'm Jules Bijal. This past Saturday, August 19th, Montrealers gathered at Parc La Fontaine with members of the Montreal Autonomous Tenants Union. The union works to help organize Montreal tenants against illegal rent hikes, rent evictions, and mistreatment from landlords. Now, they're trying to get 5,000 Montrealers to join a rent strike in protest of rising rents and the proposed Bill 31. I talked to Sarah Taves about what a rent strike is and what's at stake.
So first of all, a rent strike is a process of tenants withholding rent until their demands are met, so the rent does get paid back and you don't get evicted. This is coming in response to Bill 31, which would give landlords the power to unilaterally refuse lease transfers, which right now are used as a method of keeping housing affordable by circulating it between a community, between roommates, before a landlord can step into increase the rent. So if Bill 31 is passed, we can expect to see an acceleration of the housing crisis in homelessness, like we've already seen through the pandemic.
There's a few different provisions in Bill 31, but it's the ability of landlords to refuse a lease transfer that's drawn the most concern. Lease transfers are a key part of Quebec's soft touch approach to keeping rents low. When it comes to rent increases, the province encourages negotiation between landlords and tenants instead of strict rent controls. Taking over an existing lease puts tenants on more equal footing in those talks. Landlords have long been able to refuse lease transfers if a prospective tenant didn't pass a credit or a reference check. But if Bill 31 passes, they won't need a reason. Taves says that this would effectively kill the practice.
What landlord is going to accept a lease transfer when they can refuse it and increase the rent as much as they want? Technically, if this bill is passed, a landlord will have to indicate the former tenant's rent on the lease, but they can invent any number. There's no way of verifying this. So it'll be very easy for rents to skyrocket in Montreal, as we're already seeing.
That's why the union is turning to a rent strike, and a big one, too. They say they're inspired by the gains that similar strikes have won over the years and think the time is right for Montreal's own.
In 2020, in the U.S., a landlord association estimated that 30% of tenants were on rent strike. We're also very inspired by rent strikes in Toronto. In 2017, in Parkdale, tenants got some major wins, like a rent reduction program and maintenance that had long been neglected through a rent strike. We're also drawing on more historical precedents, like in 1963 in Harlem, tenants had rent reduced to $1 a month through a rent strike. So we're seeing these major wins that we could never obtain by going to the tribunal, and big collective wins as well. That's the other issue with trying to solve these problems legally, is that often we might get a win for ourselves, but our neighbors don't feel that.
This isn't the first time a rent strike has been tried in Montreal. There was a Canada-wide campaign during the early months of COVID-19, but that was organized in response to mass pandemic layoffs. When the federal government rolled out income supports, they took away the main motivator to strike. This time around, the strike won't start until there's strength in numbers, 5,000 tenants to be exact. That means the union is looking for Montrealers not just to participate in the strike, but to help spread the word.
Part of the goal with 5,000 tenants is that people take on the responsibility of organizing their neighbors as well, so that all the responsibility isn't on a few organizers in the Montreal Tenants Union. So we are really encouraging people to spread the strike with their neighbors.
Me alone, I'm probably not going to be able to do too much, but, you know, when you have the collective and trying to, you know, mobilize the collective power into some actions that could benefit the community, that makes more sense.
Speaking now is Clary Sanchez. He's lived in Montreal for 6 years, but just got involved with the union last month when he started having problems with his own landlord. Now he's organizing his neighbors with the rent strike, but he's getting mixed responses.
We see a lot of enthusiasm for it, but also a lot of fear, because not everybody can expose themselves like that. Even by defending my own interest, do I get in conflict with my landlord? And what happens if I have children or if I'm low income? You know, suddenly you have to negotiate all these things that intersect, you know? So I'm enthusiastic about it, but it's complicated because not everybody has the same degree of exposure to liabilities and stuff like that, especially when you are being frontal about defending your interests as a tenant.
If you're trying to organize your building, says Sanchez, it helps to build community first.
You know, you cannot force people to, even if it makes a lot of sense, to defend their own interests, but you just gotta kind of like show them what's possible to do as a community. I think the first step to advance into this kind of mobilization is to actually build a community, because you cannot really do ambitious things without having a community in the first place. If we build a community and I know them, and they know me, they can see how this affects me, maybe we can build some solidarity through that, rather than come in really hard, really dogmatic.
What's worked for him is starting things out on a lighter note.
A lot of people are already pretty stressed with their daily lives, so even though organizing can be a little bit stressful, if you're taking the lead in your building, just try to make it a little bit fun. Just to make these ideas easier to digest and actually people showing off when you require some type of organization. So, for instance, I went door knocking with my partner. We offer some cookies. We talk about, what they do for a living, you know, what are their interests. And then through getting to know them, you know, you kind of get a better picture. And, you know, you organize from time to time things like a picnic or like a cocktail night or something that to bring people together, so it doesn't become necessarily a meeting where you're gonna talk about the stressful things, which definitely is probably gonna happen, but you need to kind of like balance that.
But what about tenants' fears of reprisal? Tave says that while tenants should expect pushback from landlords, the union is working hard to avoid evictions.
Going on rent strike, for one, we have very strong legal protections in Quebec, at least for the first month of a strike. As long as the rent is paid back before a judge can make a decision, you can't be evicted. We are also imagining a significant strain on the court system, which is already clogged. With 5,000 tenants on strike, it's unimaginable that every landlord can get a court hearing. We are also planning to organize public responses to landlords filing for eviction to make it clear to landlords that they should wait out the strike instead of trying to evict their tenants. And we have lots of experience with this as a union of using pressure campaigns and collective power against landlords.
To learn more about the Montreal Autonomous Tenants Union and their rent strike campaign, you can visit their link tree at slam.matu. I'm Jules Bijal. Thanks for listening.
On va pas se laisser distraire par les discours de division visant à taper sur les plus vulnérables. Et pour une fois, on va s'organiser pour faire payer les réels profiteurs de crise, les proprios, les spéculateurs et l'État qui les protège.
When you compare the housing crisis here in Montreal to other Canadian cities, it's clear that rents are lower and life in general is more affordable here. Now, housing advocates say that's under threat because of new legislation tabled last spring by Housing Minister Francilène Duranceau. If passed, Bill 31 would allow landlords the right to refuse a tenant's lease transfer. Landlords already have the right to refuse it if they aren't given adequate notice or proof a new tenant can pay, but that would expand under the new law, basically killing the practice. Last Friday, August 25th, hundreds of Montrealers took to the streets in protest of the upcoming legislation. CKUT was on the ground to speak to some of those protesters. First up is Chantal Dano, an elderly Montrealer who's protesting in solidarity with friends who are being priced out of the city. She says that older Montrealers like her, but also young families and poorer residents, are the most at risk.
Moi, j'ai la chance de vivre en HLM, alors ça n'a pas vraiment changé. mais je connais des gens où le loyer a augmenté un 3,5 à 1300. Alors, 1300 pour un 3,5, une famille n'y loge pas. Des trois chambres à coucher à 1800, ils n'ont pas les moyens. Les personnes vulnérables, ce sont les personnes âgées, mais les jeunes familles sont très vulnérables parce que le parent monoparental avec des enfants va faire quoi avec son salaire minimum ou l'aide sociale? Rien.
Things I do is like day-to-day is working on proper education and doing those outreach with the community to make sure they know about housing rights, and then engaging the community in the defense of their own housing rights, so they know how to talk to their landlords, how they can go to the TAL, how they can collectively organize around rent hikes, evictions, and everything.
Speaking now is Mohamed Mansour. He's the community organizer at the Park Extension Action Committee, also known as CAPE.
Well, lease transfer are at this point one of the few tools we have to guarantee affordability in rent. So rent market rate rents are extremely high for a community with high immigrant and low-income population on Park X. The market rate is just too high. It's no longer affordable. So lease transfers are a way to assure that if someone's paying a low rent, they can transfer that on to someone who's coming in.
He describes the impact of the housing crisis in Park Extension, a Montreal neighborhood with many low-income residents and migrants new to Canada.
Park X is it's facing the housing crisis like every other neighborhood, and it's gotten worse with the arrival of the Compass Mill. We're seeing gentrification in the neighborhood happening in an accelerated rate. We're seeing hundreds of cases every year of evictions. People are being forced out of the places they've stayed for a long time. We're seeing people who've been there for 20, 30 years saying, now you have to leave because now the landlords want to... Sometimes the new landlords coming in, they see a way to make profit, or the old landlords are like, just now realize they have a way to make more money, so they're kicking out their old tenants. And these are a lot of people that then don't have other places to stay. This is a community that is identified with a strong immigrant communities, and it's a neighborhood that is often seen as the first neighborhood you come in. So affordability is the big reason why it was such a welcoming neighborhood. And without that, Park X loses its identity in a way. And like one concrete case is I have a father with five children who was evicted, and his only way to make sure he has a roof for his five children is a lease transfer that is ongoing right now. And right now we're still under the old law, so he still can't do the lease transfer. And under the old law, there are still obstacles too. Their landlord can refuse, they have to go to the TAL and everything, but there's still a way.
He says the provincial government's priorities are at odds with members of his community facing a growing housing crisis.
Well, I think the number of news reports that came out, the minister's own conflict of interest, sort of demonstrated where her allegiance lie. And like, she was a former real estate agent. The landlords have been, and their associations and their representatives have been for ages wanting to fight lease transfer. There was a court decision in the early 2000s that guaranteed lease transfer. And since then, it's been like on their list. They want to get rid of lease transfer. And now they have a government that's favorable to their concerns.
Yeah, I'm here today because I believe in rent control. I believe in affordable housing. I particularly believe in, you know, making sure that Montreal remains affordable for not just the wealthy. And so, yeah, I'm here to protest in particular the aspect that limits lease transfers.
This is Darby MacDonald, a renter in the city who used to work on social housing with Project Genesis.
Yeah, I mean, I have two perspectives as both a tenant and someone who used to work in housing activism. So, you know, even within the last 5 years, I mean, you talk to any tenant and they can tell you that they're almost paying, you know, sometimes double the rent that they used to pay. And that's certainly my experience. When I moved to Montreal, I was renting a room for $400, and in the same neighborhood, it can be difficult to find something for under $800 now. So there's definitely that aspect. And then as well as someone who used to work in tenants' rights advocacy, you know, we just see, you know, just a general degradation of people's access to housing, of people having to make greater and greater concessions to landlords to even access it, whether it be financial or with their personal information or even just with intrusive landlords who demand far too much of them.
MacDonald is also unimpressed by the government's approach to housing policy.
I mean, what we're looking at is just total disengagement from the provincial government of their responsibility to provide housing to their citizens, including social housing. You know, it almost feels like a joke at times, the way that the housing minister has completely disregarded the less than wealthy in this province and in Montreal. So we've seen just increased, you know, lack of interest, lack of funding, and just also overt neglect of the buildings that exist. You know, I've seen buildings that have bed bugs and infestations so bad that the government literally says they can't resolve them. So we're looking at a very dire situation for people who cannot afford expensive rent, which is honestly the majority of Quebecers. So it's completely, you know, just a complete disconnection from the reality of tenants in Quebec. So, yeah, we absolutely need more social housing. I mean, there's 24,000 people on the waiting list in Quebec. And, you know, when we talk about the city trying to put a Band-Aid on this with their bylaw, which, you know, is a step in the correct direction, but if they had listened to advocates from the start, we know that, you know, we were all signaling very clearly that this bylaw wasn't going to work as long as we left back doors open, and that's exactly what's happened.
All right, thanks so much for talking to me today. Can you just, introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about why you're here today?
Yeah, so my name is Juliana Dehokey, and I'm here today as both a tenant and a housing lawyer. So I've seen firsthand as a tenant myself how important lease transfers are, and they're so important to my clients. I represent tenants only, and it's just a really vital right to ensure that rent hikes aren't just increasing at insane numbers when landlords have full control.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit more about your work as a housing lawyer. Like, what stories are you hearing from people as the housing crisis really is intensifying in the city?
Yeah, well, at our firm, we get calls every day, way more than we can handle as far as clients looking for someone to represent them. All the time, they're being served insane rent increases.
You're listening to CKUT. The following programming is taken from CKUT's Time Capsule Archives. For more from our 35 years of freeform broadcasting, visit our website at ckut.ca.
18 hammers falling in our lives. There ain't no hammer in the ring like mine. Yeah!
Funky Revolutions, for the fattest of the funk and other liberation musics. Saturdays, 2 to 4 p.m., pure funk and the shuffle of people marching in the streets. On CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Everything I do gonna be funky.
Revolution, yo.
Check it out. For your mind and for your hips, you're tuned to the Mothership. This is the Mothership Cassette Archives, 25 years of funky revolutions. Today's episodes, we begin to present a series on the development of soul, funk, jazz, and disco in South Africa, originally aired in the winter of 2015. On today's episode 10 of